Thanks, Steve. Good afternoon, everybody. So, look, we're going to have kind of a conversation about ILS, but I want to set the stage and kind of give you my view on the sector, right? So my involvement in ILS goes back to 97, 98, when I was asked to be the head trader for a proprietary trading group that was hell-bent on risking $1 billion in insurance risk, right? And back then, the motivation was that they believe this firm, Lehman Brothers, believed that the ILS market would be kind of like the next, you know, private credit or mortgage-backed securities market, right? Multi-trillion-dollar market. And they believed that that was all going to happen on the casualty side, on the non-CAT side. The CAT side was just kind of incidental. It was seeing kind of a spark that would get the flame going in what we might loosely call insurance 2.0, just kind of an evolution of the insurance market. And I will tell you this, and you know, I love the nat cat market, clearly. I think most of us in here have, by self-selection, have come to love it. But back in those days, I really agreed with that vision. I believe that one day, the casualty market would come to parity and then exceed in size the nat cat market as we know it today. I still believe that, and I believe that the time has come for that to happen. It won't happen overnight, obviously, but I do believe all the conditions are there, and there's a lot of evolution that's been going on that sets the stage for that. So, you know, maybe you don't care about non-cat, you're in love with nat cat, and so forth, but I think, you know, if you come away from this session, just remembering and understanding, keep your eye on this space, because I believe it's going to be massive, it's going to be big, it's going to be ubiquitous. So that's the stage I'm setting here. We're not going to get too much into the details. I just want to do something high level, and we agreed to start off as a warm-up with some basic questions for the panelists. And on the first one, what was it here? The first question is, yeah, it's something punchy, okay. So each of you are going to answer individually. You don't have to answer at length. Without even going into details of what casualty ILS is, what would each of you say is a kind of a type of long-term return, given current market conditions, that an investor should expect without pushing the envelope, doing anything too crazy or too levered? Amy, you go first.
Thanks, Don. So easy, mid, high teens. Easy.
Okay, great, good.
High teens, low 20s, mid 20s.
Okay, you're a little bit higher, good.
I'm the same place, high teens, low 20s.
Okay, good. Bob?
And I'm in the same place.
You're in the same place. So you're the conservative one. Well, but it's actually mid-teens to high 20s.
Mid-teens,
right?
To low 20s, that's maybe?
Low 20s. I'm sorry, low 20s.
Mid-teens to low 20s.
And that's, again, without pushing things too hard or going too crazy, levering, doing weird things on the asset side. Mm-hmm. Okay, good. So I don't know how many of you are aware of that, but you know, I consider that to be an incredibly attractive return. And I'm reminded of an earlier session. I think it was, I believe it was George who had actually mentioned something from Oxia, that you know, private credit is a huge alternatives market. Things like 1.7 trillion. It used to have returns like that. It doesn't anymore, and I think that's a real opportunity for our market to be what private credit was back when it was kind of new and not yet with 1.7 trillion shoved in it. Okay, so that was a warm up. So now you understand the returns. And by the way, when you have returns that high, you don't have to argue non-correlation anymore, right? Actually, the format's changed right here. I'll tell you a strange story. So back in the day, there was a Goldman Sachs analyst that was asked to do an analysis about how natural cat bonds, nat cat bonds, would fit in a traditional asset allocation, stocks, bonds, real estate, et cetera. And the person hated cat bonds, thought it was just the stupidest idea and just bad. And so the analyst said, non-correlated? Come on. California slides into the ocean, you know, stock market's going to crash. So I'm going to penalize this. I'm going to give it a correlation 1. And they ran it, and the model came out and allocated everything to cat bonds. Because on a risk-adjusted basis, it's actually higher than the stocks and bonds on a go-forward basis. And if the machine thinks it's the same thing, then it's just like, well, this is just allocate everything to that. So then the analyst played around with the correlation, was trying to minimize the allocation. And zero correlation is the minimum allocation, the cat bonds, okay? So casualty, same thing. You don't need to argue non-correlation. That was a bit of a departure, but okay. So now, do each of you agree with my opening statement? This is a bit staged. That non-cat casualty ILS will reach parity and possibly exceed the nat cat market.
So, personally, for those of you who know me, I joined Ledger about 8 months ago, and all Ledger does is casualty ILS. So I am like all in. Right? I'm a huge believer in what's about to happen. I've worked in cat ILS for many years, and I'm super excited. I think it's easily going to be as large, and then quickly escalate from there.
Okay, so you don't really see that as hyperbole. You've seen it all, actually.
No, I have. I've been at this a long time.
Andres?
Absolutely. I mean, the casualty insurance market in itself is huge. And you need to just look outside a bit of casualty, take a look at what's happening in the life space. At least from a broker perspective, what we see is that these tools provide something that people need, and there's investors that want to provide it. And when you see these things happening and you see some growth, yeah, I think it's not hyperbole from our perspective.
Okay, all right.
Yeah, look, this isn't going to shock anyone, but I agree as well. I mean, the relative size between nat cat and casualty is, you know, magnitudes different. And I think probably, Bob will probably touch on this as well, but we've experienced a lot of growth already in the last couple of years. It'll take a little bit of time in terms of more growth to get there, but I hand on heart think it will get there, and we have the ingredients in place now for that growth to happen.
Right. Okay. So.
Yeah. I think we're seeing a lot of the obstacles to growth in casualty ILS falling away. There's a lot of participants now. People are coming up with some really great, you know, product design. Segmentation in the market means more companies are getting involved. Investors are, have a broader appetite. We're seeing. You know, when you look at the relative size of the capital markets to the size of the reinsurance balance sheets, you quickly see, you know, the potential for scale. Then if you look at the growth in the private credit market, we went from conservative investment strategies to structured product to private credit. When you start to see these things developing from both sides, the total return that's available is what's going to attract more and more people to join on the casualty ILS bandwagon.
Right, okay. Now, next question. So you heard it in their own words, and they genuinely believe it. I believe it. High returns, frankly, easily achieved, and the total size of market potential is tremendous, actually. But having said that, I remember I asked the panelists this earlier. It's like, how large is the current market, the current casualty ILS market size? So here, actually, we're going to maybe throw over to Bob and Andres to answer that. What's the number? Are you going to update it since we last talked?
No. I mean, realistically, it's tough to estimate because obviously a lot of this is non-public. But I think it's a very easy assumption to take up all the casualty sidecars, which are relatively public. You obviously have successful platforms, Ledger, Multistrat, you know, Longtail, which you probably know very well. It's very easy to get to an assumption of roughly $3 to $4 billion of capital was raised. And that's obviously just the capital external that was raised. And then you have all the additional assets that are being managed alongside with the capital.
Right. So it's like, well, so this is interesting. I mean, $3 to $4 billion on a $110 billion market. So if you're all wondering why you haven't heard about this before and so forth, it's because the market's still small. You know, we're talking big numbers, big returns, big growth potential, but it's only $3 billion, and there's a punchline to that, actually. So a year ago, how big would you have said the market
I mean, obviously, it's very hard to track, but if you go back and just look at what happened since September of 2023, it's eye-watering. It's really hard to argue that this market was much bigger than $1.5 billion just 16 months ago.
And is it $1 to $1.5 billion?
Yes, I think it's very hard to argue that this market was bigger.
Right, so it's tripled over the last year, roughly speaking.
Yes.
Basically. So it's coming from a very small amount, you know, that pioneers like Ledger and Enstar actually and Multistrat and others have built, but now it's tripled in size. And so that's from a very small base, you can grow like that. But do you, like, how, like,
I mean,
next 3 to 5 years, what do you think the growth pattern is gonna
be? And I let Bob comment on it, but the key is that a lot of this capital is deployed through whole account quota shares, which is what most insurance companies are really interested to look at. And it's deployed often on a multi-year basis, which is one of the primary benefits why Cat ILS is an attractive tool, as we heard today from Jennifer, right? So it has some of those features that people wanna buy. And there is a surprisingly large number of influx from investors calling brokers, dealers, how can I get involved? How can I be part of that? So when you see those elements, from my perspective, there's no reason to believe that the trend is not there. But
I think we, you know, as we see the kind of the last 18 months, we see the number of sidecars that have been established, the number of new structures that have been put in place. We've got, we've got this appetite that historically you would take the learning curve of the investor, you'd take the learning curve of the program, the seeding company, the broker. You put all these together, and usually you'd end up with about 6 months of work and probably a zero chance of losing. Okay, and we're just in an entirely different place. We've got templates, participants, appetite, investment yield. We've got product design. We've got segmentation of value-added parties coming in and offering, exit strategies like Enstar. We're just seeing so many different components. And the acceleration of all those components means that we'll see a lot more of the capacity move to third-party capital.
Right. You're saying on the supply side, from the investor point, supply of the risk, obviously it's a big world, it's a massive market. I mean, some people will say that non-CAT is, 30 times larger than CAT. So, and obviously if it's paying you these types of yields, that implies that they're not swimming in capital to take on the risk. It hasn't compressed the yield. But you think that on an investor demand perspective, it could support a doubling or tripling of the market?
Absolutely.
Each year for the next 3 to 5 years, let's say?
Yeah, I don't have a crystal ball, but I do believe that it's going to be a banner year in 2025. And I am happy to make that leap of faith that if the growth is thoughtful, and if the structures are sustainable, and if everybody is on track to really do what they need to do, I don't see how this growth would not continue to 2026. But 2025 will be a banner year for this market.
So that means that we could break 10 billion. So go from a billion to 10 billion, which is an important milestone, in 2 years. You know, how long did it take the capital market to do that, actually? 10 years, maybe, actually. Something like that. So growth pattern is really, really strong. Okay, let's see here. Yeah, I think the next one, now it starts to turn a little bit more into a conversation. So very punchy, high returns, high capacity to grow from a very near zero base, effectively, in the grand scheme of things. Rapid growth, looks like we'll maybe get past our $10 billion mark. And by the way, keep in mind that the way that I insisted that we talk about the size of the ILS market is the smallest number possible. And casually, unfortunately, some people have a habit of talking about gross underlying premiums. So the numbers they're truthful, and it's the way people talk about casualty. But here we're talking about casualty in the way an ILS investor talks about, right? You know, I'm committing $10 million at risk, so I've got $10 million invested. Let's not talk about the fact that underlying that is $40 million or $50 million. In premium. So we're really not trying to overstate it. This is, equity invested in the asset class. It's growing fast. But really, for me, the next question that I'd be asking if I was you is, like, what took so long? You know, if I, you know, say I thought back in the late 1990s this would be a big market, why did I do cat bonds first? You know, nat cat first. And the real reason why is that it was just my brother and I in a laptop in a windowless room. You know, you back then to do casualty deals, it was like it was almost like a mini semi-hostile M&A type transaction. I mean, you 20 people working, you're pulling all-nighters, like you say, and six weeks of crazy amount of work, you destroy your health, you destroy your life, and then the deal doesn't go through, right? So that's because a lot of the infrastructure which now exists, you know, didn't exist back then. So the cap, you know, when you're actually transferring a great Miami hurricane, California earthquake, easier to build the infrastructure for that. But really, I mean, what else are we missing here? Like, what took it so long? If the potential has been there all along, are there other trends that have actually brought us to this point?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of things. I kind of look at casualty ILS as kind of two major groups. There's kind of more of the risk management side where you've got MGAs who are looking for capacity and, you know, things sit very nicely alongside traditional reinsurance there. And it's a way for a fronting carrier to diversify its panel to get, you know, maybe better terms based on what the risk return profile looks like. There are a lot of cool things that are going on there. And I think as you see this proliferation of the whole MGA world, that helped. I think that really helped with the acceleration, especially the acceleration that we've seen in the last few years. And then I think on what I'll call more the capital efficient ILS structure, so the really big sidecar deals. I think a lot of it is down to insurance companies and reinsurance companies really starting to change the mindset, look more and more at capital management and, you know, what's really most efficient? Is it better for me to raise, you know, permanent capital? Or is it better for me to think about flexible capital, something that's available on a multi-year basis but has a lot of flexibility in it? And what does that look like? And how can I maximize, you know, fee income? And how can I really use my skills but pull that the capital out of the capital markets and let them get a really good return and kind of everybody wins?
Right.
And I think that because those types of structures are happening and, as you said, the infrastructure is there, I think we're going to see more and more and more of those.
So I don't want to put words in your mouth, but are you saying that, like, the attitude of the insurance and reinsurers has actually changed?
Yes.
So it's kind of like the insurance 2.0 is more flexible capital.
And look, you know, when it comes to, and, you know, I was the buyer of reinsurance at AIG for a while. So, you know, I think about it's so critical, right? The reinsurance relationships are so critical to that risk management relationship. And, you know, that's kind of a lot of the focus, you know, and thinking about where in the capital stack I need the most help. And a lot of it does end up, you know, CAD and XOL, you know, excess loss covers and that kind of thing. Sure, there's some casualty, but it's more pocketed. All of a sudden, you start thinking about whole account quota share and what that means and what you can really do against that. And it's the fact that, you know, I said it before I joined Ledger. Samir and I had a long talk, and I was like, you've got investors who are up for this? He's like, oh, yeah. You know, and now that I've been at Ledger, it's absolutely amazing how much that market has, you know, the availability and interest of the investors and the array. I mean, we're at the point now where we can really speak to any risk originator of any type, whether, you know, it's an individual MGA, a pool of MGAs, pardon me, a large insurance company, reinsurance company, you name it, and whatever it is they're looking for, we have different investors who are interested in that. I want shorter duration, I want longer duration. It's really that ability to match that risk with the capital now that's just taking off. As Andre said, I think we're just right at that hit point where this is gonna just explode.
Right.
Really exciting.
Now, there's a lot that you touched on there. It's all important. I wanna take kind of one point at a time. And it involves everybody here on the stage, which is really interesting. I mean, one is that you mentioned, like, whole account coverage. Mm-hmm. So maybe, and then you talked also about, I think that the NSTAR is very much involved in too, tranching the tail and so forth. But Andres, will you talk a little bit more about this whole account coverage and why that
Absolutely.
Is a relatively unique or special thing that the ILS market's doing that the reinsurance market isn't doing?
Absolutely. I mean, first and foremost, obviously, investors are interested in accessing relatively low, it's a lot of work, right? But generally speaking, when you want to do this, you want to have scale. And to get scale is more important than trying to pick out of 100 lines what are the top 5 lines that maybe have a better loss ratio. You're not trying to pick that alpha. What you're trying to do as an investor is find a stable block. What these guys are used to do maybe on the life side is find life business, which is predictable, stable. Theoretically speaking, the more stable, the bigger the casualty block, the more stable it is. Yeah. Now, separately, what the insurance companies often see is that their reinsurance partner would like to pick line 2, 4, 50, reinsurance partners would like to pick line 1, 2, 14, 16, and 18, because they believe that those lines will outperform. And the whole account quota share ultimately allows an insurance company to sleep well at night that none of their lines or none of their specialty MGAs will be left without a reinsurance coverage. And some of these whole account quota shares are not 100%. So all it does, it says, okay, I'm removing 20% from the table. All it does is effectively increases your capacity.
Right, but I mean, so as a paranoid investor, you might hear, well, that reinsurer is smart. They're cherry picking the best lines. If we take it all as a package, maybe that doesn't make sense from an investor point of view. How do you defend that practice?
Obviously, the fundamental difference here is investment returns. So the casualty market itself is going through quite a good time. Right? It's very hard to know which casualty line is going to have the greatest underwriting performance. Investment returns and generating good yield is a core part of this product. And the fact is that if you look at investment yield of many insurance companies, it's often you see 2%, 2.5%, 3%. At the end of the day, an investor that is able to invest in a thoughtful way, even if the underwriting comes out to be, at 90
average.
To 95, mm-hmm. Yeah, they can still generate these returns that we're discussing as long as the block is stable and they can thoughtfully invest.
Okay, Bob, you want to add anything to that?
Yeah, I completely agree that kind of the whole account quota share is a kind of fit for purpose, timely opportunity. It may be age, but whole account quota shares historically have been written by traditional writers. Delegated underwriting authorities have always been a concern. The ability to be adversely selected against is a concern. And we're talking about casualty. So disciplined underwriting and analytics are core to everything we're doing. Collectively, that's critical. We have different platforms. We have established companies with whole account quota share needs. We have MGA aggregators who've got books of business that have been recently assembled through acquisition. We have, distressed and new programs that get added. And so, I think our view is a whole account quota share is a way to scale up and bring investors the kind of capacity that makes it worth their time to dedicate capital. But the critical issue is, do you have a balanced, diversified portfolio? And have you done a good job of underwriting it at a granular level? And then over time, are you managing and servicing it? Are you on top of it? Those are going to be critical elements for me to get comfortable to write whole account quota shares as an underwriter.
Right. I mean, you've been doing this a long time.
Yep.
Right. So it's not what you're reminding everybody, it's not a brain dead activity. Just close your eyes and just take any account and then achieve the type of returns that we're talking about.
Yeah, a great example would be, there's always classes that are distressed. So let's talk about commercial auto for a second. If you're presented with a whole account quota share opportunity and 40 to 60% of the book is commercial auto, that's telling you something, obviously, right? That's not a balance in a diversified portfolio that's going to make sense in the current market conditions. So part of it is a negotiation. You have to work with the company that you're sourcing the business from. And ideally, you're sourcing business from a number of different platforms so that you can put together the best diversified portfolio. My only point is that I really don't want people to lose sight of is it's still casualty underwriting. And we all need to do it well in order for this growth to generate track records that we can all then have investors rely upon.
Right. But I think what is different now, and I wonder if you agree, is that here in this market, I claim it's true in Nat Cat, you're actually underwriting the underwriters, basically, right? Now, I would say that in Nat Cat, that at least perceptually, that's easier to do. And in casualty, in the old days, I thought it was near impossible. I mean, you'd ask them for the data, and they'd say they don't have it. And I believe them. You know, they actually did it. They had a lot of paper and files that you were free to look through, but, you know, you start, and, you know, it's like, this is useless. It's like, I'm not going to be able to figure out what's going on here. But that has changed dramatically, right? I don't know.
Some of the transactions we get involved in, at the end of the day, the investors are capital market investors. They may not know exactly what the loss rate issue should be for commercial auto. So what they do is they engage professional actuarial firms to stress test it to make sure that the overall proposition is thoughtfully constructed.
Right. Amy, this is a lot.
And now I'm like,
Ledger does. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so yes, we at Ledger certainly do a lot of analytics work on that front and provide information to investors on that basis, just like a reinsurance broker would to a reinsurance company. Hey, you know, here are some things to think about. Here are ways to tweak. We have a lot of investors. I see some of them in the room who are incredibly sophisticated. They've built kind of their own models. We help feed information and work together. I would say that one of the key differences actually between casualty ILS and cat ILS, having done both, is that casualty ILS is experience rating. So it's experience rated. You can look at, you know, massive quantities of aggregated data and look at loss triangles and figure out, hey, you know, where does this portfolio go, and you know what historically has been the expected loss ratio versus the actual expected loss ratio, et cetera. There's just a lot of data there, and it's harnessing that in a very efficient way, and translating that, and helping investors understand that. And now they're taking off and kind of doing their own modeling. So that's why I think this all works super well. I think that was one of the big impediments. You know, how do you really convince investors to understand and believe in casualty modeling? Because there is some level of
right.
subjectivity that exists
right.
in it.
We could spend a lot of time talking about that, but I'll move on to the next thing. So obviously we have a lot more data right now. And I think that one thing's not quite touched on is that increasingly, especially in the MGA space, you're seeing people come forward and their every bit of alignment and intention is not to have any junk in their whole account, right? But I liken it this way here. So just imagine going to a restaurant, and weirdly, within the restaurant, you have to go to several different places for all components of your meal. Like for the bread and butter, you have to go to one window and pay out and so on and so forth. You know, that can be the experience for some insurance companies when they're getting reinsurance for the casualty whole account. Because the specialization when the market's so intense, you know, you go to one person for this part of your portfolio, another person with another part of your portfolio, when you just want to insure the whole meal, right? Very, very difficult. And there can be some complex, you know, reasons and context historically why that worked and so forth, but things have changed. And, you know, what I see about the ILS market is that they want that package, as you're saying, Andres, right? Diversification. I mean, I always thought it was funny because in the cat bond market in the early days, they say, no, I want to write North Carolina only. Then I want to write South Carolina. Then I want to write, like, each individual state, right? There were a lot of players that way. I go, what are you going to do after that? And it's like, well, I want to write all 50 states and collect together. And it's like, why don't you just jump right to the answer and do a PCS 50 state loss thing, you know? But it's like, no, I want to craft it all together. But in casualty, you definitely want the whole meal. You don't want to... Yeah. Just a glass of water to start and a piece of bread. You want the whole thing.
Many of the investors are comfortable with capital market volatility, fixed income volatility, equity volatility. They understand that there will be volatility from the underwriting, but they would prefer it to be as stable as it gets versus trying to achieve alpha through underwriting alone.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, the more lines you have, the more diversified it is, you know, the more you kind of over time, you know, you've got some mean reversion in there. It all just, you know, really makes sense. I think, as Andres, you mentioned, you know, your traditional reinsurers trying to create their own portfolio, the lines they like, the type of structures they like, where they're playing in the capital curve and the risk, you know, risk return curve and creating their own big portfolio, as opposed to necessarily taking on, you know, a pre-diversified portfolio. And I think there's you know, we're seeing certainly some really good interest in retro. When I say retro, sorry, I don't mean retro. Well, there's interest in retroactive, obviously, but in casualty retro. So you see the same thing where reinsurance companies can say, hey, there's a really great opportunity here. I want to have flexible capital to underwrite against that. I want to be paid for that. pardon me. And you know, you're getting a pre-diversified, while they can, certainly, but you don't see a lot of casualty reinsurers looking to do retro. They already have that. Like, they've already built their own portfolio. They don't necessarily want to support their competitor, right? So it's that access to a completely different capital base. It's hugely, hugely attractive as well.
Right, right. By the way, I do want to make clear, none of this is meant to be actually a criticism about how traditional reinsurance operates in casualty. Yeah. You know, these are very established practices, high specialization, tremendous amount of expertise, and so forth. But I think that what we're really talking about here is how the ILS market is different, and that can potentially bring value, especially to MGAs or, you know, new companies that are part of, I would claim, of insurance 2.0.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to take the keep talking here, but one thing I want to touch on that quickly is, you know, this happened in CAT early on, right? Like, insurance companies, you know, used to work for Willis Capital Markets and said, oh, you know, what if I have a loss? What's going to happen with the cat bond market? Are they going to still be there? Is this repeatable, et cetera? Are they going to stay with me through? And, you know, that's been proven out as a, you know, with a big thumbs up. But the same issue exists with casualty now with investors. And I think what's been really, really positive is, like, every investor that, you know, we've spoken to in the last, you know, year, you keep hearing from them, I want to have a relationship. Yeah. And the insurance company, reinsurance company, fronting carrier hears that. It's music to their ears, because that's what they have with traditional reinsurers. It's very powerful. And the fact that investors want to be partners has also changed their attitude about, hey, wait a minute, what's going on in the capital markets? This is cool.
You know, that's really interesting, because I think in contrast to Nat Cat early days, and it's still a weakness now, we heard this in an earlier panel, the attitude tends to be a little bit opportunistic. It's like, call me when the market's hard and that's it. But I think that the casualty investor has a completely different look at it. Long-term, committed, and structural. And that is a better match for, because obviously that's what an insurer is looking for in a partner. The next thing I want to touch on that you touched on, I think, is very interesting. I mentioned the mortgage-backed security market before. So mortgage-backed security market, especially with 30-year mortgages, right? That's a very, very long tail amortizing. So that was it. You just sold that package 30-year final, you know? And the market kind of hobbled along. It's when they started tranching it, when they started creating securities that had a 10-year final, because they could find somebody separately to take 10 years through 30 years forward, that market really took off. And I think that this is where Enstar really does come in particular. And could you talk a little bit about the background of that, especially through the legacy market?
Sure.
Like, here we're talking about new business and you back it, right? But as you've pointed out, you had a really nice thought piece that in the old days, really casually ILS was kind of runoff business. Could you explain that a little bit more?
Yeah, sure. So look, I think putting an investor hat on, if you have a 5 to 7 year duration on your investment, on your asset side, how do you write a 12-year duration liability in a sidecar, third-party capital vehicle? You can't. You can't do it. So really, I think one of the, one of the other ingredients that probably has helped the growth and will hopefully continue to help the growth is finding an exit after your asset duration. So you're artificially saying, listen, I have 5 to 7 years on the asset side, and I'm going to artificially make my, I'm going to force the liability into that same duration, and then I have clarity and clarity on the exit. So I think for us at Enstar, it's kind of what we do in terms of hindsight underwriting. Now, this is a little bit starting to blur where you're saying, listen, it's prospective underwriting, which will turn into hindsight by the time it commutes. So we're you know, I think it's a stretch for the legacy market, but one where, you know, we're very happy and very thrilled to sort of, you know, put a step into and see how it goes. And, you know, I actually think that The first step was to say, listen, trapped capital, even in the property net cap side of things, has been an issue for the industry. And you know, we did a couple of transactions last year where we basically tried to provide a solution to existing trapped capital issues.
And on the nat cat side?
On the nat cat side.
Okay, good.
On the nat cat side, which, frankly, the events have happened. They're just waiting to settle. And, you know, we can take that settlement risk and underwrite it. Then we sort of started thinking, as we went through a couple of those last year as well, that, hey, actually, what would be pretty exciting for investors would be if, at the time of investing, at the time of funds raising money, there's an option and a clear exit at the end of their investment duration, right? At the option of the investor, and with a clear enough parameter on what that exit valuation would be, that you can price it in up front, right? So you can say, gosh, this thing is a low 20s IRR, right, in terms of return, with this certainty of exit, at which, you know, I can choose to either, you know, exercise the option on or not, me investor. You know, it becomes a high teens IRR or a 20% IRR, mm-hmm. right? And then they have the ability and the courage to say, listen, I can make a decision. And I can make an informed decision of whether I want to invest or I don't want to invest. So I think it, again, just takes some of that uncertainty out of the system. And then, you know, the legacy market, I think we're playing a narrow role in kind of a broader solution set here, which, again, from an NSTAR standpoint, we're very, very happy to do. But that's how we think about it in terms of trying to deliver that.
But you have a lot of experience in legacy. Could you explain to the audience exactly what the legacy market is, right? It's a seasoned portfolio of casualty risks. So you've had time to see it actually perform.
That's right. So, you know, Amy touched on this a lot, right? Casualty has a lot of experience, you know, at least from an NSTAR standpoint. And most of the things into in the legacy market, you know, are, you know, driven by casualty, so it's dominated by it. So it's something that, you know, again, we've been around for 31 years, we've been doing it for 31 years, and that's been bread and butter. I think the industry has sort of changed a little bit, right? So old legacy was you had a problem, asbestos, right? And you go find a solution, and you probably took a big hit for it, but you know, everyone cheered because you never had to talk about it ever again. And then I think new legacy has been more, hey, actually, this is a pretty interesting market out there. I'm a primary carrier, right? I want to raise more capital or to deploy into new underwriting. Gosh, it's expensive and hard and time-consuming to actually raise new capital. I've got a perfectly well-performing back book that isn't problematic. It's seasoned. But gosh, actually recycling the capital against that to deploy into new business is faster and more efficient than if I went to go raise capital. So that was sort of the journey from the legacy market, which was well established, how it sort of went from problem portfolios to capital solution portfolios to now capital solution strategic, maybe a little bit more in the mix type portfolios. So you know, hopefully we see that develop on the legacy side too and continue to be a good player and good supporter of this industry.
Right. Andrus, do you have anything to add to that? I mean, that whole, doesn't that make the broker and the agent channel happier?
I mean,
rather than the insurance company just sitting on this old legacy portfolio and not doing business because of it, they do new business.
The type of investors that can participate now is significantly greater. I mean, it would be fantastic if every investor would have mandates for, you know, indefinitely permanent 20 years. I'm sure you would like that too. Permanent capital, but the fact is that most people have some fund duration. And this transaction, and NSTAR's ability to get involved there, just opens the door. And now you can actually cost accordingly, you can actually like really figure out how much of the returns are you willing to consider to make sure you have definite certainty of exit, and you can present it to the investors. It really opens up, I think, the universe of investors.
So this is kind of a yield curve that you're describing right here, right? Like Amy, you answered in the mid-teens, you know? Others like mid to high teens. Really, it sounds like, you know, some of you are talking about the longer tail stuff, and then the shorter tail stuff is lower. But I think in a more formal basis, like if you just say, oh, call me conservative, I just want 3-year final. It's like, oh, that's great. You know, you might have like a 10% or a 12% return, not a high teens. So you can do that, and you're going to have to surrender a lot of other stuff to a specialist like Enstar or whoever on the back end. But as I say, when the mortgage market went through that, it went from sub-trillion to 10 trillion just like that overnight.
You know, I think there's no question the exit solution is something that, you know, for some of us who've been doing this for many years, was something that we priced in as an option in our models, but didn't necessarily have the markets ready to provide the product. So what we said to an investor is, at year 7, at year 8, at year 9, if you want to exit, here's the kind of multiple you'd have to pay based on a third-party view of what it would cost in the market. Having capacity to actually front-load or bake in the exit is great. It is a game changer, and thanks to Enstar and others, you know, I think our question is going to be, will there be enough capacity for that to keep up with the kind of growth that we may be talking about? The second observation I'd pick up on from earlier is casualty is ILS is different in another way than catastrophe oriented business, and that is two ways. One is the investors are very different. They're asset managers. They want to gather assets under management. They want to have the long term relationship. I completely agree with that. You know, the second, you know, difference between those is to put these casualty ILS transactions together, we need really strong partnerships. Okay. We need fronting carriers, we need brokers, we need investors, we need legal firms, okay? We need, you know, third-party actuarial firms. We need a lot of people who get involved in helping us put these deals together. And it's important to point that out because we need to build strong relationships with all those people to be able to execute. Whereas in a cat bond, you know, you can almost have a direct relationship with a particular insurer. They've got a particular need. They buy out the required catastrophe risk. The broker places it. The contract is pretty well templated, and it can execute. Mm-hmm. But just to say, some of the things that I actually obviously have believed for a very long time that this was going to work. So I would just point out the things that we have to get right, exit solutions, partnerships, the growth in the fronting carriers has been really helpful to create flexibility and collateral and investment guidelines. The knowledge of the brokers has just increased, and the investment that brokers are making now is really helpful. But there are things we need to get right. We need to get the exit solutions right. It's a formula basis. So if you don't underwrite well in 7 years, when you have to apply that formula, that's going to come at a very high cost. Okay? Or if you try to exit at 3 years and there's not enough certainty around the liabilities, it's going to come at a high risk premium, to your point, John. So we do need to tackle social inflation. Okay, and how we're all going to structure and underwrite for that, price for that, manage claims around it, get policy wordings correct, you know, just to fight an ongoing battle in that area. Investors want to understand how that's going to work, and we need to be able to be very convincing in terms of how that'll work. The next is track records. Okay, investors want a track record. We're not a great industry at track records. Okay, we're not the investment industry that has mutual funds with auditable track records that create 5-star ratings. Okay, we have TPAs that change. We have MGAs that change ownership. We have people who didn't invest in systems to capture their own data, and so we substitute with benchmarks and actuarial expertise. But my point is, this whole industry, if it really wants to get behind that partnership with investors, needs to understand that track records are essential. Collateral efficiency is essential. And the difference between funded collateral and unfunded collateral is something that has to be very well understood, well disclosed, and well managed over time. If we get those things right, we won't stumble on this growth path. And that's what I think is kind of key for all of us to realize.
Right. Now, I mean, there's obviously it's investing, so there's a lot of issues that need to be addressed. But you would still say it's fundamentally different than the Nat Cat market, certainly versus early days. And this is non-cat ILS. My head casualty underwriter, actually, that's what he called it. He just calls it non-cat.
Not cat. Yep.
Okay, you mean casualty? He's like, no, non-cat. And still, a lot of people actually do say that. And there's a lot of virtues to non-cat, much as I love the cat market. actually. It's more of a cash flow thing.
Yeah. It's, you know, high frequency, low volatility is really, you know, these whole account quota shares are structured that way. In fact, I'd actually argue just a little bit that social inflation matters less because you're capping things out at a much lower level. Not, you know, there's a whole wonderful reinsurance market that's very, very adept at figuring out, you know, the effects of social inflation and what's going to pop up above, you know, $1 million or $2 million threshold and price that correctly. But, you know, in that lower, you know, very modelable, lot of data area,
right.
I think, you know, we can really address some of the issues that investors might be concerned about.
The thing about, okay, so actually I told Bob not to mention social inflation, but he did it anyway, which is fine, because everybody knows about it.
I'm not always well-behaved.
That's great, that's good. You know, but I will say this, is that, you know, what you don't like is things like that aren't being priced into the marketplace, right? And obviously, if you just do a basic Google search, you'll see it's on everybody's radar screen, and they're looking to price it in, but you still need to underwrite the underwriters. And I do think it's a lot easier to do this in this market than actually in the nat cap market. So it's good that you brought that up. You know what I might do right here is actually just put it out to the audience for questions. You know, we did it on purpose. We didn't get into any details exactly what a casualty transaction looks like, what are any of the gotchas, if anything, and stuff like that. Because I just wanted to pique your interest and alert you to the fact that there are a lot of serious people that have been working on this a long time. And I think that work is finally coming to fruition. Full disclosure, I'm directly working with people around the stage, and if I haven't yet, I will be. You know, so I think that this is a serious core of the market that you're looking at here. And this is your opportunity to ask direct questions of them. So I want to throw it open to questions here. We have here in the front row, if you'll wait for the microphone, please. If you will, please favor me with your name and your firm. Thank you.
Sure. Hi. Hugh Hill, VH5 Capital. It's my personal advisory firm. Very good panel. Thank you very much to everyone.
Yeah.
One question for all the panelists. Given the change we've seen over the last decade in the life and annuity industry and the advent of private equity and the corresponding changes within the traditional life and annuity carriers, what analogies, parallels could you any of you draw between what we'll see with the now obviously nascent growth, but in the non-CAT ILS sector here and the changes that are coming here? I know Dave has touched on it a little bit, as did Amy, but I'm curious as to what the panelists think about that and what parallels we can draw.
Right. Hey, I just want to make sure I understand your question, Hugh. So, like a lot of people are aware, you're talking about, like, say, Apollo or something like that,
sure.
The big, huge moves that they're making on the life and annuity side. Is there some connection to what's going on here? Is there some similarities? Is that what you're asking?
Sure, just obviously becoming much more asset manager driven there. As well, also you're seeing the traditional life and annuity carriers moving to more of an intermediary or originator or syndicator model from your MBS days.
Right, okay.
And so I'm curious what you'll see, if we're going to see any of that in the P&C industry.
Who would like to?
Yeah, I mean, I think at its core, like, that's a lot of what's going on. Trying to bring risk to the capital markets, and where the insurance company or reinsurance company is starting, you know, in those instances, is being more like a MGU, if you will. You know, somebody's getting paid for underwriting, and the risk is actually, you know, going right out, or a chunk of the risk. So, kind of an interesting analogy.
So initially, when you're entering the sector, you know, you may consider, for example, doing like a bespoke sidecar, 3 years. Let's see how it plays out. Let's see if I can capture those investments. What is really special about the life space is dedicated insurance companies owned by the asset managers out there to acquire blocks. And I think if the market plays itself out and the private credit investors and the diversified asset managers can capture the returns that they're seeking, it's not inconceivable for me that you would see dedicated reinsurance companies emerging by large asset managers that are actually interested to proactively secure some of these blocks.
Okay, so Hugh, I mean, I think I just want to make sure everybody agrees. I think it's an interesting point, right? Because what was revealed in these are almost like mega trends that are going on, right? Is that if it's done right, and you can just even get an extra 50, 100 basis points in a prudent manner, right, on a conservative fixed income portfolio, the leveraged effect on total return is huge. And that is absolutely the case right here. I mean, what would you say? Because, I mean, Andrew, I thought you were going to jump all over this. You had said, and I don't, because I don't know, in the traditional market, it almost looks like it's pricing in that on the assets, on the float that you're, that you've got, that the premiums that you're holding before you pay them out, right, that the market is pricing in, it's, it almost sounds like a T-bill type of return or lower.
It's not uncommon to see 3-to-1 operating leverage in some of these casualty vehicles. And at 3-to-1, maybe, you know, the ones that, you know, it can range, right? But in a 3-to-1 operating leverage, even at treasury levels, you can generate interesting returns.
Okay, good. But in the traditional reinsurance market, what's the implied asset return, you know,
no matter what it is, well, again, having worked for a lot of reinsurance companies, but they the credit that they give to the discount rate that they use is essentially, you know, risk-free match to the, you know, meantime.
Okay, so, and I'm not criticizing it, but as a
matter of convention. No, it's conservative because insurance companies don't, you know, they have their own, reinsurance companies have their own rules around how, you know, aggressive or not they can be with their investments. So they don't, you know, other than some of the total return reinsurers that have operated, you don't, you know, in the traditional reinsurance front, you're not getting that type of approach from.
So putting there what Amy and Andrus are saying here, Hugh, if you can actually prudently go outside of T-bills and not do something crazy, you've got a 3x effect on that excess spread, right? If you can pick up an extra 100 basis points prudent, yeah, easily, then that's another 300 basis points of total return. So a lot of what we've been talking about right here is all underwriting side, right? But there's just as much opportunity on the asset side. And again, you don't have to swing for the fences or do anything crazy. It's so big. So I do think it actually is a continuation of what the Apollos of the world are doing. They were just doing things in huge block size, big, visionary, and so forth. But I think that eventually this is just as big as what they're doing, maybe 5 times bigger.
You got one over there.
Yeah. Great.
Thanks, everyone. Andre Perez from the Nason Group. Thank you for an excellent panel. I'm not so sure about the parallel with the life insurers, to be honest. And while we have the, you know, the float and the acquisition and the investment income, at least my personal opinion is that we're dealing with much more volatile book of business on the casualty side. And so, you know, the part that, and it's not a loaded question, I'm genuinely interested in the answer, is, you know, right now we have a favorable interest rate environment, right? And so that's the question that has to be asked is what happens when, you know, interest rates are not as good and market returns are not as good in terms of, I mean, we've seen casualty deals where basically the entire return is based on the investment income, it's not on the underwriting return. Mm-hmm. Whereas on the NatCat side, right, we're dealing with much lower expected losses, and so you do have, you know, a fair margin of underwriting profit built in it because you don't have the investment income. So my question to the panel is, what happened when we return, you know, to the interest rate environment that we had 5-6 years ago?
So, Andre, and thanks for the question. Are you saying that, for example, what happens if we go back to a zero interest rate environment?
Correct.
Right.
Exactly.
Right.
Well, yeah, I was going to say one of the things that happened that was a very significant factor in the slow growth of this whole category initially was being in a low investment yield environment for a sustained period of time. So the leverage couldn't be deployed. And so I do think that if we had a widespread market dislocation sometime later this year or next year that impacted equity and fixed income returns, then we'll have to ask ourselves a question. Are the alternative investors going to keep dry powder to try and take advantage of a 2008-type situation, or are they going to view this as an attractive alternative asset to invest in when they can't get yield in some of the normal ways? We don't know that. I completely agree that casualty has more volatility than life does, and sometimes it's an embedded volatility that's hard to estimate, and it reveals itself over time, right? And so at the same time, having the ability to generate a total return through underwriting return and through investment return with turns of leverage is really powerful in trying to create a high frequency, low severity, attractive risk-adjusted return.
But actually, answer, how would you answer Andre's challenge? Let's say we go back to zero interest rates, T-bills are zero.
Sure. Whatever.
Then what's the return on this? Like, how would you revise what you said at the very beginning there about the mid-teens to low 20s type of return?
Well, if you're a traditional balance sheet company and you're not doing cash flow underwriting in a, I won't say social, economic inflation environment, you would use your investment income to offset your underwriting, right? And if that's not available, then it has to be a repricing of the casualty risk.
Exactly.
And that means instead of all of us accepting a, you know, 4 to 6 net return on the casualty just on the underwriting margin side, we're going to have to be looking for 8 to 10. You know, or more to be able to create an adequate risk-adjusted return. So it's going to be a repricing
for the market. It might be 8 to 10 in that environment, exactly. Once the dust settles.
Both of it cut and just goes like
that. Everything like that.
Yep.
So Andre, I acknowledge everything you're saying. Again, this is why since the late 90s I've been out of the market. You know, we've all seen some things on the casualty side, and this is kind of reverse cherry-picking. You're seeing all the offensive stuff that, you know, wasn't spectacular and makes casualty look like it's not such a great business. But I think that really it's almost reverse cherry picking, right? We were seeing kind of deals that were not really great by design. But my opinion was that always the underlying market was more like this. I thought a high single digit in a zero interest rate environment. Obviously, your mileage can vary, right? If you want to be negatively selected for as an investor and accept junk like that, then you know you're going to get a horrible, not a great experience.
And I would just say, John, you know, in a zero interest rate environment, the question is the relative return, right? So if there aren't alternatives to invest, and you're generating 0% returns in conservative investment strategies, or maybe 1 or 2 points, we don't have to come up with an investment return on the casualty product that outperforms. We just need that single high single digit.
I got to tell you, 8 to 10% in a zero rate environment would fly.
Absolutely would fly.
I mean, we had near record inflows when the cap bond market was turning a 3 to 4% net return in a zero interest rate environment. That's 2014, 15, yeah. 16.
Yeah. I think the uncertainty around the cost of goods sold will always have a haircut effect on that single digit return. So if you're an investor, you'll say, okay, you might be generating 8 to 10. I'm going to assume that's 6 to 8. You know, it's still attractive, but you have that behavioral haircut that you will apply. So when we talk to, you know, mid-teens to high teens or low 20s, there's a human behavior that says, I don't know casualty, I don't know reinsurance, I don't understand how long tail risk is priced, I don't understand tail development. I'm going to haircut it in my own mind. So I think, you know, the 8 to 10 will be adequate because it really mentally will be like a 6 to 8 return in terms of their value judgment. Yeah.
Yes, Chen.
Hey, John, thank you for the panel. Question more related with, you know, how do you understand the performance and pricing, right? I mean, we've seen just recent quarters, a bunch of large reputable reinsurers strengthen their casualty reserves. The feeling is, you know, for NatCat, right, some bad happened. We as the industry can respond to that observation pretty much right away. But for casualty, right, like, you know, you found something wrong. I mean, everybody was talking about their bad performance during underwriting years between 2015 and 2020. We do an investment today, right? 5 years later, we're like, wow, we were so wrong, but it's so late, right? I mean, how do you address that? And secondly, right, I mean, to your point regarding interest rate environment, you know, today we're doing underwriting assuming 4.5, you know, risk-free return, but 2 years later, right, that becomes 2 or 0, but your underwriting assumptions were already down, right? So you're not really doing a forward-looking curve, say, okay, you know, today it's 4.5, but 3 years later, that's 1 or 2%. So just wondering how do you, you know, also, you know, sort of, you know, combine that, you know, into your underwriting decision-making process.
That's a great question. much.
Wants to take that.
Bob. You want to go first, Amy?
No, I was thinking Bob. Yeah,
well,
you're an underwriter.
They're two really good questions, right? Yeah. You know, the first is, how do you price a product today that its result will be known over a period of time? We've all, almost all of us, I'm sure, have had traditional reinsurance experience, and we've dealt with soft market cycles. We've dealt with you know, finding that we've underpriced a product, and 2 or 3 years later, we've ended up with a much larger problem. So it absolutely exists, and you know, these are some great companies that have had to unfortunately take some pain. And it wasn't just this year; we've seen it the last couple of years of some of the groups having to address it. We're building synthetic balance sheets. We're not buying into the legacy of an established core of 10 years of underwriting, which will materialize over time. So there is some advantage to this product in that we're selling today's price, hopefully informed by the most recent experience. And in that way, we'll leave to David what we used to call the future inventory at Riverstone. We'll leave to David the advantage that comes from underpricing. The second question, headed forward is, did we price at a risk-free rate? You know, and did we take an assumption of investment income into our pricing? Okay, and you're sitting next to a gentleman who's got a lot of experience in the industry, and we watch soft market cycles where people used high interest rate environments to underprice their underwriting product, you know. And in this case, you know, what we have to say is because we are underwriting each year, we have to do what any other traditional underwriter needs to do on a go-forward basis. We need to reevaluate, reprice, establish revised terms and conditions to determine how to set the best price, but I think the other element is, in dealing with any inflationary trend, it's pricing, it's claims management, it's risk selection, it's terms, there's so many different aspects you bring into the underwriting to try and get that outcome that it's really important. The other thing I'm nervous about, I will say, is putting out 3-year capacity or multi-year capacity without adjustable features. If we have our preference, we like annual capacity and a very strong relationship where there's an expectation of a renewal, because that gives us a chance to get around the table again and reset the next year. And if this market moves to everybody wants to buy 3-year capacity on a locked-in basis, we are going to see that risk emerge where we've got embedded losses over time.
Andrews.
There are multi-year structures out there where you're simply following the form of the traditional market. Mm-hmm. If you have a diversified casualty portfolio, the ceding commission may not be like pre-negotiated 3 years into the future. You're simply benefiting from the given market conditions and what the rest of the market negotiates for those specific ceding commissions. If the performance is not great, the ceding commission will get adjusted each and every year.
Right, yeah. But I just want to, Chen, I think you're speaking like, and it's a little bit like Andre's question there. The return is not solely from the assets. So in my opinion, actually, really what it is that if you write it correctly, instead of it like T plus, like T bills plus 6%, it's 3T plus 6, basically. So if that T floats down, it's okay. It doesn't wipe you out. But as I say, instead of having a T plus, you have a 3T. And you can do asset liability matching too if you want to lock that in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Great. So thanks for all the questions. I think, we're all out of time, and really appreciate all the questions. Thank you. Mm-hmm.